today. Why was John Allen Chow trying to make contact with one of the most remote tribes in the world? And did the actions of a British colonialist more than a century ago contribute to his death? And in opinion, John Harris on Airbnb's role in the Dublin housing crisis. We'll start after this. John Allen Chow believed that a remote Indian island was Satan's last stronghold. The 26-year-old American missionary was obsessed by his conviction that the Sentinelese Islanders needed saving, a community who have chosen to have no contact with the outside world. When Chow arrived in one of the most remote places on Earth, he was killed. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in focus, North Sentinel Island and the strange death of John Allen Chow.
So North Sentinel is part of an Indian territory called the Andaman and Nicobar Islands. And they're located somewhere between the Bay of Bengal and the Andaman Sea. They're sort of scattered across the sea there. If the Andaman and Nicobar Islands are the middle of nowhere, then North Sentinel Island is the middle of the middle of nowhere.
Michael Safi, The Guardian's South Asia correspondent, has been covering this story.
And it's a really heavily forested island, about 20 square miles across, so that's about two-thirds the size of Manhattan. And it's fringed by some really beautiful beaches, though you probably wouldn't want a holiday there. It's home to a community who we call the Sentinelese. We call them that, but we don't know what they call themselves because we've never had a conversation with them. They speak their own language, they have their own lifestyle. We've never been able to communicate with them, nor them with us. Anthropologists estimate there are about 100, and that's based on the size of the island. They say that a habitat about 20 square miles across can probably support life for 100 people. We know that they hunt fish using bows and arrows and spears, and they gather what they can and forage from the habitat around the island. But as far as how they spend their day, how their community is structured in terms of hierarchy, all of that is a complete mystery. We simply don't know.
When you're trying to research a story like this, which sounds like it's about the most mysterious island on Earth, how do you go about it?
Well, I mean, you turn to the experts, and in this case, the expert is an Indian anthropologist named T.N. Pandit. And from about 1967, for the next three or four decades, he basically dedicated his life to trying to reach the Sentinelese. His efforts were mostly fruitless. I mean, he barely got a response from these people for decades.
We landed on the island. We explored the beach and found a footpath.
He followed a kind of dirt path up through the forest.
A kilometer or maybe a mile inside the forest.
And was just astonished to find 18 wooden huts, like a proper settlement.
We came upon a large settlement of 18 huts.
And he said that out of the corner of his eye, he spotted a man sort of disappear into the trees.
They were watching us, but they didn't show themselves. They decided not to do anything. We were totally ignorant and we could have been attacked.
T.N. Pandit says that the overriding lesson he learned from his time interacting with the Sentinelese was that
my personal opinion is we should leave them alone.
They ought to just be left alone. I mean, they don't want to have any contact with us. They have nothing that they want from us, nothing they want to give us. And we ought to just respect their wishes and, I guess, leave them alone until they change their mind.
How do we know that they want to be left alone?
Well, they make it really clear. In 1974, there was a National Geographic team trying to shoot a documentary on the island.
We came at last to what is known as the North Sentinel Island.
Although they shot the director through the leg.
A member of our film unit was wounded by one of the many arrows, each 2.5 meters long. He will carry this scar till his death.
But then a few decades later, after the Indian Ocean tsunami, an Indian Navy helicopter tried to fly over the island to assess the damage. And they shot an arrow at that too. And then a couple of years after that, a couple of fishermen were trying to illegally harvest crabs from near the island, and their boat drifted in the middle of the night, and they both woke up having run aground on North Sentinel Island. And the islanders attacked them. They hacked them to death with axes, and then they buried their bodies. And a week later, dug them up and propped them up on bamboo sticks like scarecrows facing the ocean. And you know, when they're not being violent, there are also reports that they have just turned their backs to anthropologists and other visitors, and they squat as if they're sort of defecating, which is, I guess, is a pretty unmistakable message even across cultures. And then, of course, there's the case this month of John Allen Chow. John Allen Chow was a 26-year-old from Washington State in the US. Chow was apparently a man of great faith. He was a really fervent Christian. He had volunteered overseas in places like South Africa. He was someone who appears to believe that he was kind of on the earth to fulfill a kind of holy mission. And since about 2015, he became really obsessed with the Andaman Islands. He visited at least 3 times, according to the Indian government. And his friends have told different media outlets that he would talk a lot about the Sentinelese. He was captivated by this story of a tribe that had been virtually uncontacted for thousands of years.
So how did John go about getting to the island?
He got there in the ordinary way. He arrived as a tourist. Tourists are allowed to visit the Andamans. And so he arrived around October 16 and stayed in the kind of usual tourist spots. His friends say that a plan appeared to develop in his head, that this island he had read and talked so much about, he would actually try to visit. Around the 14th of November, he paid 5 fishermen on the island 25,000 rupees, which is the equivalent of about 275 pounds, to smuggle him past Indian Navy boats and through the buffer zone that the Navy enforces around North Sentinel Island. And according to Chow's diary, they arrived a few hundred metres away from the island about 10:30 p.m. that night.
And we know about all of this because he actually wrote about the experience.
He did, yeah. He kept a journal and he wrote about the encounters he had over the next couple of days in a place that he referred to as Satan's last stronghold. So the morning of the 15th, about 4:30 a.m., according to his diaries, he took the boat into the shallows of North Sentinel Island, and he writes that he and a few fishermen got out and stood up in the shallows. And for about 4 hours, he just waited. He waited to see if anyone from the island would present themselves. And by about 8:30 a.m. that morning, he decided he was sick of that. It was time to change strategy. I mean, if they weren't going to come to him, he would go to them. And he writes in his diary, "So I got a little closer as they, about 6 from what I could see, yelled at me. I tried to parrot their words back to them. They burst out laughing most of the time, so they were probably saying bad words or insulting me. I hollered, 'My name is John, I love you, and Jesus loves you.' I regret I began to panic slightly as I saw them string arrows in their bows. I picked up the fish and threw it towards them. They kept coming. I paddled like I have never in my life back to the boat. I felt some fear, but mainly was disappointed. They didn't accept me right away," he writes. He wrote in his diary after that that one of the Sentinelese, who he said had yellow paint smeared across their faces, one of them, a 10-year-old boy, had actually shot an arrow at him, and it had pierced this waterproof Bible that he had taken onto the island to preach the gospel to the Sentinelese. Incredibly, despite this unequivocally hostile reception, a few hours later that afternoon, just before 2 p.m., Chow went back onto the island. And he says that this time he was confronted by six Sentinelese men with bows and arrows, and that behind them he saw a group of women. And so he tried to shift his attention to the women. He tried to preach the gospel at them. He tried to give them fish and other gifts. Just to be clear, he's standing at a distance from them at this point. He's not actually in their faces. But he puts the gifts down and goes back, and they come forward and take the gifts. And he manages to survive this encounter because he writes about it later that night. He goes back to his boat, and he resolves that the next morning he's going to return to the island. But he writes about it in a way where it seems like he knows he's been warned. The next morning, before he went out to the island again, he gave his diary and a letter for his parents to the fishermen and told them that they should try to meet him somewhere near the island the next day. The letter to his parents said, "You guys might think I'm crazy in all this, but I think it's worth it to declare Jesus to these people. Please do not be angry at them or God if I get killed." And sometime between going to the island that morning and the next day when the fishermen went to the meeting point, we believe Chow was killed, because the fishermen say that they saw a body that looked like his being dragged across the beach and buried.
Do you think the Indian police will recover his body?
It's looking pretty unlikely. If they go onto the island and the Sentinelese start shooting and the police have to defend themselves, I mean, do they want to be in a position where they're killing members of this tribe to try to recover Chow's body? I think that's the last thing they'd want to do. So the widely held idea here is that it's very likely his body won't ever be recovered.
Was it legal for John to go to the island in the first place?
Well, it's kind of a grey area. Earlier this year, the Indian government lifted a long-standing ban on foreigners going to North Sentinel Island, but the authorities in the Andamans say that tourists still had to seek permission to go and that Chow never sought permission. So it's a grey area, but in all likelihood, he didn't jump through all the legal hurdles he would have needed to go there legally.
And why is it they're stopping people going to North Sentinel? What are their fears?
Well, their fear is basically, other than the fact that this is a pretty aggressive tribe that doesn't want any contact with outsiders, the fact of their isolation, the fact that they have spent so long without contact with anybody, means their immune systems are very different to ours. And so arriving on the island with something as basic as a cold could effectively wipe out the entire tribe. We just don't know how strong their immune systems are.
Has there been a backlash in India against the case?
There has been a really significant one, because India, of course, is a former colony. And so for people here, the idea of a Westerner coming to their country thinking that he has a kind of ideology to preach to them, he has new ideas that he can impart on them. I mean, they know that story. They've seen it before and they know how it ends. And so they're very, very reluctant to continue breaking the rules to try to retrieve Chow's body. It's something that I think very few people would be supportive of here. That antipathy towards colonialists is actually something that some people speculate the Sentinelese might share with other Indians. One of their few encounters with the outside world was with a British colonist, with a commander in the Royal Navy. His name was Maurice Vidal Portman. And in the 1880s, he was given responsibility for pacifying the Andamans. He seemed to have a strange obsession with photographing and trying to kind of categorize and understand the tribes on the island. And in 1880, he went to North Sentinel, and according to a book he wrote, he arrived on the beach and found that it was deserted. And so he followed a trail into a settlement, where he also found most people were missing, except for those who apparently couldn't run away quickly enough, and they were two elderly people and four children. So he kidnapped them. He just took them on his boat and returned to the larger islands, which by that point in history were being used as a penal colony. And he found that the two elderly people he had picked up died pretty quickly. And the children survived. He never says what he did with them in that time, what kind of tests or observations he tried to run. But he returned them to the island a short time later and wrote that he thought the whole encounter had really permanently soured relations between his administration and the tribe.
And presumably the children then who were returned have passed that story down through the generations.
Well, that's one theory, yeah. It's that this early encounter with the outside world for the tribe was one that was a really hostile one. I mean, they had members of their community, including children, kidnapped. And that wasn't very long ago. That was only about, 140 years ago. So it's entirely likely that this fear, this suspicion was passed down the line only a few generations and might explain the hostility with which the Sentinelese greet anyone who tries to come to their island.
So it sounds like the islanders have good reason to want to protect themselves. They want to remain isolated, and the Indian government has supported that. But, John Allen Chow has been killed. Will anyone be held responsible?
Well, police have registered a criminal case against unknown tribesmen, but they concede that there's a few practical hurdles in terms of actually prosecuting anyone, because even if they're able to identify with some degree of confidence who actually murdered Chow, then something as basic as telling them what they've been charged with, which is a requirement in most criminal systems, is going to be almost impossible here because, there are no translators for Sentinelese. There's no one who speaks this language. We don't know what concept of law or justice this community lives by. And so you wouldn't even be able to follow the basic procedures of a criminal trial in order to actually prosecute anyone. So the idea that someone will be charged is a little bit ludicrous.
Are his family comfortable with that?
Yes, one of the first things his family said after the news of this emerged was that they forgave the people who did this. They forgave the Sentinelese, which in turn rubbed people up the wrong way because, it's this idea. It doesn't acknowledge that what Chow was doing was A, incredibly dangerous to the Sentinelese, but also is loaded with this historical baggage of Westerners, of Christians, coming to an Indian territory with ideas they think are superior and trying to impart them on the population.
Michael, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, what's the problem with Airbnb? Welcome back. Now, The Guardian's John Harris has been to Dublin to ask what impact our holiday rentals are having on the housing crisis.
Jenny Quinn is 33. She has been homeless for the best part of 2 years, and she lives with her 10-year-old son in quite a small room in what the Irish government calls a family hub, which is essentially emergency accommodation for homeless families. And she and her son sleep on a metal bunk bed. Most of the people in these family hubs tend to be single mothers with their kids. It's not outrageously awful accommodation, but I instantly had the sense that if you lived there, quite soon you would start to feel very, very sort of hemmed in and that your horizons were shrinking and that you were living in a very confined space, which is what it is. The hub that she's living in is in a building that used to be a convent, and the convent housed nuns who ran the infamous Magdalene laundries, which were these absolutely awful places where the Irish state, through the 20th century, or most of it, put unmarried mothers, and they were serially abused and mistreated and effectively incarcerated in those places. So she is acutely aware of her environment and its history. One of the many factors that's making the homelessness crisis and the housing shortage in Dublin and Ireland. One of the factors that's making it worse is the volume of Airbnb rentals in Dublin. Like all cities which attract lots of tourists, it has lots and lots. And according to figures that were put out in August, the number of Airbnb flats in Dublin that were available compared to the number of private rented flats, the ratio was about 3-1. So there's obviously a real imbalance. Because it was part of the story, I took the option of paying £95 to stay in an Airbnb flat on the north side of the city centre. You only had to set foot in the kind of stairwell for where I was staying to know that most of the people who live there are families. There were baby buggies and tricycles and stuff on all the landings. And straight away, the fact that I paid £95 to stay there for one night tells you everything you need to know about the economics. It's much, much more profitable for a private landlord to rent out a flat on Airbnb than it is to rent it long-term to somebody or a family. One of the things that's said about Dublin is that the city's housing economy is so messed up that families live in hotels, that's emergency accommodation, and tourists live in houses, Airbnbs. In the 80s, the Irish government stopped building mass public housing. At the same time, the consequences of the crash of 2008 have meant people can't get access to mortgages anymore. So home ownership is declining. And in the midst of all this, rents in Dublin are skyrocketing. So they're the ingredients for a sort of perfect storm. That's why, essentially, you've got a housing crisis. Dublin is a very, very modern city. Around the old Docklands, it's full of the European headquarters of tech companies. So Google employs somewhere in the region of 8,000 people, I think, in Dublin. eBay has got its HQ there. Twitter's got its HQ. Facebook. And in this glorious feat of symbolism, in an old warehouse building, I think, Airbnb has its European headquarters. But it's a great symbol of a lot of what's gone wrong. Airbnb isn't the root cause of it, but it's making it worse. The government has announced that from June last year, it will introduce a limit of 90 days on Airbnb rentals on short-term lets. Now, that's a step in the right direction, but the rates for rentals of Airbnb in some areas of Dublin are so high that even 90 days will be more profitable than renting it out for a whole year to a permanent tenant. So there is rising awareness of this problem. I just don't think we've arrived yet at a convincing solution to it. Dublin is where the shortage of housing is at its most acute and visible, and it's tangled up with all these very modern factors. But they are things that you see all over Europe, right? So there's a huge housing problem in Denmark. There are housing problems in Poland. There are housing problems, I was amazed to learn, even in Germany. This is a Europe-wide problem. I went to Dublin to tell a Dublin story, but really the same factors apply in lots and lots of places. What this is really a story about is the failings of the way that modern societies are run and the fact that most governments in the West haven't really got to grips with housing as a problem.
Read John Harris's piece in G2 and online. That's it for today. My thanks to Michael Safi and John Harris. Today's episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin, Mythili Rao and Rachel Humphreys. Sound design was by Axel Cocutier. The executives were Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. If you're enjoying Today in Focus, then go on, leave us a review. And maybe 5 stars? See you tomorrow.